702
on 92.7 and 106 FM.
Streaming on 702.co.za.
The 702 app.
And on DStv channel 856.
Ray in for Bruce on The Money Show, which is brought to you by Absa CIB, winners of the best service in Africa at the Euromoney Cash Management Survey 2021. That's Africanacity. Absa is a registered FSP. Well, coming up in your program in the next 2 hours, finding out shortly about SohoSun Gaming's half-year results. It's a difficult time during COVID, and that's the big thing. Let's have a look at what they've done and perhaps what they're going to be doing, because think about it, we've got this horrible fourth wave on the way. In fact, we'll be taking a closer look at what this means for business. If we do have this fourth wave, what is going to happen during the Christmas period? Rudy van der Merwe, he's a portfolio manager at AdviceWorks. He'll be chatting to us about what's happening with the markets, specifically the Rand, which seems to have recovered somewhat from after what happened yesterday. And then later on talking about how do you build a business when capable talent is scarce or unaffordable. Pavlo Fotidis, he's the founder at Orica Business Accelerator. He'll have some advice for us. But I'd like to hear from you. What should we be doing as we perhaps may have to lock down if there is a fourth wave? What should we be doing? There are questions about the liquor industry, questions about the entertainment industry. I'd like to hear from you. Leave me a WhatsApp voice note message on 072-702-1702 or leave an SMS on 31702 or 31567.
702. Let's walk the talk.
Streaming countrywide on the 702 app.
So let's climb right into it. SohoSun Gaming's half-year results have been adversely impacted by the closure of the group's businesses due to COVID-19. We know these things. This was the result of the third wave of the COVID-19 pandemic. We're now looking at a possible fourth wave this December. On the line is SohoSun Gaming CEO Chris du Toit. Hi, Chris. Good evening. Welcome to The Money Show.
Hi, Ray, and thank you for having me.
Right, so SohoSun Gaming appears to have weathered the storm, just looking at your statements, looking at what you've had to say. Take us through where you are now with the business and what's happened over the past 18 months.
Yes, Ray, it's been a bit of a roller coaster ride for us, as you know. And I must say it's quite great to be back into profitability for the first time in a year and a half. However, even though we're profitable for the first time, we've still got to be realistic. We're still 35% below our pre-COVID levels. And I mean, if you look at the period since the year end, then if you think from April to September, we actually didn't have any month that was like a normal or a good month for us, because there were restrictions the whole time, varying from a 9 o'clock closure time to 10 o'clock to 11 o'clock, and they even actually only from the 1st of October, the time was relaxed to 11 o'clock on the level one. So October was actually our first great month since year end, but still we managed to grind out, I think, quite decent results for the 6 months, regardless of the tough times.
Yeah, it certainly appears that way. I mean, I'm looking at some of your figures now. You've done really well. But now concerns about the fourth wave. And I've been to, say, Monty and other places like that. And, you know, that people can get into gambling. Are you looking at sort of bigger restrictions that come with this or not really?
Look, Ray, we're obviously hopeful that the vaccination rate is sufficient that by the time the fourth wave hit, there's not further severe restrictions. However, I mean, we all got the news of there's a new variant around and numbers are picking up in Gauteng. So it's definitely a risk to the business. In this last 6 month period, we didn't expect to get closed down completely again, because with the second wave, we remained open throughout, just with more strict regulations. But then with the third wave, government made the decision to move us all to level four and close us down completely. And obviously, if we close down completely, it's a big setback for the business, because you don't only lose your earnings, you also have still costs that you've got to carry. And then obviously, you make quite a big loss and then your cash flow is under pressure and your debt level start going up again. So with the upcoming fourth wave, I mean, we're hopeful that the government will be sensible the vaccination rates are increasing. So, I mean, we hope that they will maybe at some point just make the regulations a bit more strict. But we're just hoping that we don't get closed down again because, like I said, that's very bad for the business.
Chris, how did you survive the past 18 months? I'm going back into after what happened in March last year. Did you have to lay off staff? Where did that leave you? You sort of went into lockdown mode, but what did you do to survive it?
It's a bit of a one-dimensional strategy that we had the last 18 months, and then the survival strategy was just cost. I mean, if you don't control your cost during a pandemic like this, you won't survive. So effectively, we just had to look at every single cost in detail, and obviously you've got to take cash all the way as well, so you've got to hold back on your capex. But the major theme was to control our cost, and I think that's where we were very successful. I mean, fortunately, even before COVID, we already started looking at the cost of the business, and we did manage to cut some of the cost out of it. But since COVID started, obviously, we had to accelerate that significantly and look at it a lot more in detail. So, but I think we've been very successful in curbing the cost, and now actually, even with restrictions, We're managing to operate on a month-to-month basis with positive EBITDA and positive headline earnings thanks to these savings. And one hope that would have some sustainable positive impact on the business post-COVID. It's just the one thing that's really tough for the business is the curfew. Because as you are aware, the casino businesses are not made to close early in the evening. I mean, our businesses are made to trade a bit later at night. So that's prime trading time for us after 9 o'clock, 10 o'clock, 11 o'clock, whatever the curfew is from time to time. That's the hours we really need to cover our cost and obviously be positive, yeah. Profitability.
Chris, did you find, though, that during the day things sort of picked up? Because there are those who love their gambling, you see. And did you find that people went during the day and your numbers actually picked up there because people needed their fix?
Yes, right. I think the positive thing is people still want to be entertained. There's a lot of people say everybody's going online and so forth, but people want to be entertained. So we believe we will be back strong after COVID. So, I mean, your question basically, were there a change in behavioral pattern during the last 18 months with people basically changing to come in earlier? And I mean, absolutely, if you look at our numbers, it is clear from even a year ago that there's definitely been a behavioral change where people are starting to come in earlier. However, with these curfews, you are still restricted, and it would be better if we can trade later. But I'm quite comfortable that, I mean, the entertainment, hospitality industry will come back. We just need to get past this next period.
Yeah. Soho Sun Gaming CEO Chris du Toit, great to have you on The Money Show. Let's keep talking business now. Let's keep talking about what the next month may actually mean for us as South Africans, as South African business. Now, the country is currently experiencing a lower than expected uptake in vaccines, leaving the cold storage facilities with an excess of 16 million jabs. These are the latest figures. What does this new variant actually mean for South Africa's fight against COVID-19? And what can we expect for business? Well, on the line is the health chairperson of Business for South Africa, Dr. Stavros Nicolaou. Doctor, good evening. Welcome to The Money Show.
Good evening and thanks for having me again.
Right. So we're looking at this fourth wave. We're looking at this new variant. What are you expecting with regards to Business for South Africa?
Right. Firstly, I think the only predictability here is the unpredictability. Were we expecting a fourth wave? We certainly were. No one could predict the timing. It would appear, because we're starting to see the manifestations of a fourth wave. We're by now all aware of the discussions of the new variant, which will be named officially tomorrow, I believe. So I can't say this is entirely a surprise. what might be a surprise is it's come a little earlier than anticipated. But what's important is how we manage and deal with it. We certainly don't need further hard lockdowns, and the lockdown patterns have largely been determined by the strain on the healthcare system. So the more you have a surge in hospital admissions, particularly ICU admissions, the critical care admissions, the more likely you are to start moving back into lockdown scenarios, unfortunately.
Yeah.
So this is largely in our hands. What has been disappointing, of course, is that the vaccination rate has dropped off quite sharply in the last 6 to 8 weeks. You've outlined the numbers. We are now sitting with a significant oversupply, around 160 days worth of stock in the country. A very different problem to what we had 6 or 7 months ago, where we had an undersupply and an over demand. It's now gone full circle, and we have a very little demand and an oversupply of vaccine. So there are two things we need to be doing here, Ray. The first is we need to be encouraging as many people to get vaccinated as possible. Now, we don't know what the impact of this variant will be on the current suite of vaccines that we have, but it's highly likely that these vaccines will demonstrate some efficacy against the variants. We know that. And secondly, we have to stop any super spreader events. I'm exceedingly concerned about RAGE. I think it's next week, right? And other similar super spreader events. And I think we've got to take responsibility as a society around those two things. And my very final point is we are backing and forthing on mandatory vaccinations in the workplace and in other parts of other parts of society. But countries have gone ahead with this. As recently as yesterday, I hosted the president of Kenya, President Kenyatta. He was telling me what they've done. So from the 21st of December, any Kenyan that wishes to access any facility, a public facility, like a train or public transport, or the workplace, is going to have to be vaccinated. And I think we need to be following suit. It's enough dilly-dallying on this issue. We need to move ahead with it as a country.
Yeah. Moving ahead, I mean, you're also the group senior executive at Aspen Pharma. Are we in a situation now where we're going to go back to those same lockdowns? We're going to go back to the same thing? Because there are concerns that with this new variant, from a medical point of view, that things may change, that we may need to get new jabs and things like that to respond to it.
Craig, we don't quite know what the next 2 weeks are going to bring out. I think we've got to remain optimistic, cautiously optimistic. We've experienced variants, albeit that this particular one seems to have more what we call spike protein variants than the previous ones. The two that were particularly concerning to South Africa were the Beta and Delta variant. Right? The Delta variant, the one we've just encountered, it was extremely destructive. So we don't quite know what the next 2 weeks are gonna bring. But what we do know is that when the cases go up and people become severely ill and the strain is placed on the healthcare systems, that is when government tends to move into lockdowns, so that it eases the burden on the healthcare system. And as I said earlier, the only thing we can do right now is we've got to continue practicing the protocols, ventilating, masking, and all the other protocols that are well established by now. And we also have to drive the vaccination program. We've dropped to 110,000 vaccines a day, down from a high of 290,000 was the highest recorded. And we need to get it back to levels of 300,000 to give us a really good fighting chance.
Yeah, it certainly is very, very concerning that people are just not getting their jabs. Health Chairperson of Business for South Africa, Dr. Stavros Nicolaou, thanks for being on The Money Show.
The Money Show.
The Markets.
Right, let's see what's happening with the markets. Rudy van der Merwe is a portfolio manager at AdviceWorks. Hi, Rudy. Good evening.
Good evening, Ray.
Right, the oil shares, some sort of flat on the day, I would think. Take us through what happened this afternoon then.
You're quite right. Largely flat on our markets. It's a reasonably dull day. Not a great deal happening. It's obviously an American public holiday today. And as a result, I think markets are just reasonably dull and treading water, really. So we had a couple of sets of results out today. Obviously, you spoke to the Toho Sun guys earlier. Mr. Price also came out with a set of actually quite exceptional results. But other than that, it's really not a great deal of activity on there.
Yeah, I see, like you said, Mr. Price making some gains, their results up, but that was also from a low base, wasn't it? Because you're coming off a COVID-19 lockdown when sales were down, so things didn't look nice and rosy for you, but not really.
Yeah, there's a lot of that in all the numbers we see coming out at the moment. Obviously, people coming off the real bottom of the worst portion of the lockdown, so the results do tend to be flattered by that, but... We are seeing some companies bring out results that are exceeding pre-COVID numbers, and Mr. Price is one of those. You know, their headline earnings a share were sort of 10% up on pre-COVID numbers. They're gaining traction from a market share perspective, probably gained about 2% of market share. Their margins are expanding. Their online business seems to be firing on all cylinders. So all in all, despite it being flattered by a low base, this is really a good set of numbers.
Yeah. Rudy, the miners also under pressure. Is this due to the metal prices? Because gold has dropped quite a bit, also platinum as well.
Yeah, it is. Generally, we're in an unfortunate position that a lot of what we export has been under pressure the last while. Iron ore, for example, has come down from over $200 to in the region of currently about $100 a ton. We've also seen platinum and palladium and gold prices, for that matter, largely coming off from where they've been earlier. So that obviously has consequences for our trade balance and the rand. At the same time, we're seeing oil prices spike up, which were very low last year, which exacerbates that situation and then makes the currency even more vulnerable. So those are having impacts on commodity producers. I think the other thing is just the outlook for growth generally is vulnerable. You know, we're seeing a resurgence of COVID infections in the developed world and in Europe. And also, there are a lot of concerns about slowing growth in China and the vulnerability of the demand for commodities to their property market, which is looking like it's about to take a beating. So that's a massive driver of demand for commodities, and I think that's having an impact on people's view on the forward earnings of a lot of the commodity companies.
Yeah. You spoke about oil prices, and you see the United States, Great Britain, Japan as well. They want to release some of their oil reserves to drive prices down. Is this going to work? And also, is this going to work for South Africans? Because there are lots of South Africans are very bleak after that last sort of increase in fuel prices.
I don't think it would do anything positive at all. A total waste of time. You know, it's a drop in the ocean. They've got the reserves, although it sounds like a lot, you know, 50-odd million barrels that the U.S. could release, is an absolute drop in the ocean compared to what Saudi Arabia could produce. So the OPEC at this stage is just, you know, it's an organization that exists purely to manipulate oil prices. If you and I try to manipulate something, they'd throw us straight in jail, but it's fine for OPEC to do it. And they've got spare capacity at the moment of about 6 million barrels a day that they could pump and are basically refraining from doing to engineer higher oil prices. So if the U.S. were to release and other developed markets release some of their oil reserves, there might be a very short-term blip. OPEC could easily counteract that by just pumping even less oil if they wanted to.
Yeah.
And then you'd find that OPEC is back to squeezing you in a situation where you've got zero reserves. So it just makes them more and more vulnerable. I think they'd be far better placed confronting OPEC and saying, well, you know, if you're going to restrict the flow of oil, we can restrict the flow of other goods that you may in fact need,
yeah,
like medicines or computer chips or vehicles, whatever the case may be.
Yeah,
some
vicious,
sort of embargo would be, I think,
a vicious cycle. Pepkor, some of the others up today as well. Who are you looking at today? You said it was a bit of a flat day, but some people were making some gains.
Yeah, there were certainly Mr. Price was one of those. That was a really good result. And I think the company was up about 4% on share price today. And I suspect there's further gains to go there. And then we also had a decent set of results from Co-op Agri, which was up around about 20-odd%. Headline earnings, on recurring headline earnings. And it actually seems like their earnings are reasonably defensive. And that looks quite attractively priced at current levels as well.
Yeah. Rudy van der Merwe, Portfolio Manager at AdviceWorks. Great to chat to you once again on The Money Show. We'll chat to you again soon. It's just gone 6:30.
The Money Show with Bruce Whitfield, proudly brought to you by Absa Corporate and Investment Banking. Proud winners of the best service in Africa at the Euromoney Cash Management Survey 2021. That's Africanacity. Absa's a registered FSP.
Talking now about the role of corporates in the fight against gender-based violence and femicide. South Africa has a major problem with GBVF. You know this. You know the latest police stats have indicated this. Well, Magna Carta, as a PR agency for the Gender-Based Violence Respond Fund 1, has been invited by the JSE, I like this, to ring the bell and also participate in the panel discussion around the role of corporate SA in combating the scourge. What can corporates do to stop this? That's the big thing. Well, joining us is the British High Commissioner to South Africa at the British High Commission, Anthony Phillipson, who is on that panel. High Commissioner, hi, good evening. Welcome to The Money Show.
Thank you very much indeed. It's a great pleasure to be with you.
So when it comes to corporates, what can corporates do to stop the scourge? If they, for instance, see somebody who's working for them and they're getting themselves into a problem, what can corporates do?
So I think there's a couple of things. First of all, we all know that we need to work together to tackle the scourge, as you call it. I think that's exactly the right word, of gender-based violence and femicide. We also know that a lot of this happens in the domestic place. And especially during COVID, where we have collapsed the workplace into the domestic space, it means that we need to bring this conversation even more into the workplace. So a number of the companies, the British companies invested here in South Africa, a number of South African companies, I'm sure, have, you know, real commitment to well-being and mental health and looking after their employees. But I really think it needs to include this crucial topic of gender-based violence.
Yeah.
The second thing is that, you know, companies are always thinking about how do they position themselves to be at the leading edge of discussions. We've seen this in CSR over the years. We've seen this in ESG. And they are responding to shareholders, they're responding to customers, and they're responding to their employees. And it's their employees who are the ones rooted in the community. So that's why I think it's so important that companies are part of this discussion as we take it forward.
Yeah. But sort of besides that, being part of the discussion, is there more of an aggressive approach that corporates could perhaps take to stop this, like I said, scourge? Because it carries on again and again, and we see these campaigns coming and they are welcomed. But what else can they do?
Well, I think they can really get engaged in the conversation about the type of workspace that they're creating, and especially, as I say, during the time of COVID, that workspace is in the home. We know, because we've seen the evidence, that the very high rates of violence against women and indeed against children, a lot of it takes place at the hands of a trusted partner or someone that they know. So corporates, I think, need to make themselves part of this discussion. The other thing I would say is that I think whether it's on issues like climate change or whether it's on issues like the impact of gender-based violence and femicide on economic activity, these are serious issues for economic players. And the final thing I would say is that I think there's a role for companies, and indeed there's a role for organizations like the British High Commission here in South Africa, to get engaged in a conversation about creating opportunities for women in the workplace. We do a lot of work through what we call the UK South Africa Tech Hub about digital access programs for women, about female entrepreneurs. We have a wonderful, wonderful program called Future Females. So giving women a place in the future of the workforce, the future of the global economy, I think is also part of the mix.
Yeah. And perhaps as well, and you actually touched on it, when it comes to earning money, for those who don't earn enough, I'm talking about women as well, but for those who don't earn enough, perhaps corporate should have a look at salaries, have a look at the cost of living, see what's going on in people's lives. That will then release the stress that comes with going home and there's an explosion.
I very much agree. And if I can maybe just take it quickly into sort of the global place as to how the UK government has handled these issues or wanted to engage in these issues over the years. And our current Foreign Secretary has really put women's economic empowerment and girls' education right at the heart of the foreign policy priorities of the British government all around the world. The Prime Minister has made this a key theme of his G7 presidency this year, and we had President Ramaphosa at the G7 summit in June. We invited Foreign Minister Pandor to the Foreign Ministers' meeting in May, and looking forward to seeing her in Liverpool in December. Because this is a global conversation. We need to talk about this in the G7, in the G20, in the WTO, all about creating those opportunities for women within the global economy. And we're also putting serious resource into this as well. So we invested here in South Africa in the Solidarity Fund last year to the tune of 25 million rand today. In the panel that you mentioned with JSE and a number of others this morning, we announced a further 10 million rand contribution to the new GBVF Response Fund, and that will support its call for proposals to address these issues at the grassroots here in South Africa.
Talking about that, and we've seen what has happened, and I love the way different countries are tying into this, but is there buy-in to something like this? I mean, there's lots of discussion. Could there be formulated policy that comes from this? Policy perhaps for corporates as well?
So I think it's all about creating a conversation, and it's about creating a framework, it's about sharing best practice. And in each individual country, the context will be different, and therefore the solutions need to be different. But I think if we can get a global commitment to addressing the challenge, if we can get a global commitment to countries working together and sharing best practice, then that is the way forward. On the 16th of November, so last week, the Foreign Secretary launched a new campaign to end violence against women and girls and to tackle sexual violence in conflict around the world. And so again, that's another part of it. And we want to take this forward, as I say, whether it's in the G7, G20, the WTO, maybe even the OECD, the UN. We want to be present in all of these discussions and making sure that the solutions to this is evidence-based and rooted in the countries where we need those solutions to play out, because all of the countries are different. You can't have just a top-down. It's got to be bottom-up as well.
Yeah, indeed. British High Commissioner to South Africa, Anthony Phillipson, thank you so much for coming onto The Money Show. I do appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
Walking this talk together.
Every hour.
Every day. This is 702.
Let's walk the talk.
Very interesting SMSs coming through. One says, Ray, lockdown once again. Government must know that we can't have a repeat of this. The public are fed up. It's an interesting SMS that you have sent through this evening. And you're right. People are fed up with the lockdown. And we've heard lots of complaints about, I don't want to get the vaccination. I don't want to do this. But the bottom line is, and having just a listening to Business for South Africa and what they had to say as well, this new variant, it's on its way to us, and it's very interesting today. I witnessed news reporting on it that this variant, there's very little that is known about it, and 22 people have got this variant. And there's lots of sort of worry that's gone into this, and what happens if more than 22 people get it, then it expands. And then all of a sudden, we're sitting with a situation in this country where we have to lock down once again, because it's maybe, I'm not saying it is, but it may be a deadly variant that comes along, and unfortunately for us, could cause a lot of damage and close business down. So the NICD, they are looking at this just to see perhaps, you know, how severe this is and what we should be doing. And of course, we've got Christmas coming up as well. And that's the big problem, because with Christmas coming up, there's Christmas shopping, there's going down to the beach, there's all sorts of things. But if we do have this anticipated fourth wave, well, that's going to be a huge problem, a very huge problem. I'd like to hear from you. 011-883-0702 or 021-446-0567. What should this country be doing to deal with this fourth wave. Should we have another lockdown? Should we have a situation where we lock down the country? Is that the way to go? Of course, remember, with lockdowns, what comes with lockdowns? It comes with booze bans and curfews and things like that. So what should we be doing to perhaps curve this horrible thing that is coming our way? And I say it's coming our way. Doing business reports over the past couple of weeks, one thing we have noticed is the fact that the Northern Hemisphere, they have been locked down totally. In fact, Austria, they locked themselves down totally. Germany looks like they're going to be following there. So what do we do with this? I'd like to hear from you. 011-883-0702. Malete and Alex, hi, good evening. Welcome to The Money Show.
Good evening, Ray.
Your thoughts?
Yes, I think we should vaccinate and be little on the partying and weddings. This thing is coming very hard now. We should be very careful in everything that we do. I know they might close some other things, but business is now very bad. We should just think for ourselves. I mean, we must save ourselves. But I've already vaccinated. Yeah, I didn't have any chance because I was working. I was going to other people's houses, so I couldn't take a chance.
Yeah. Do you think, Maleta, though, that, sorry, do you think that there should be an enforced lockdown now, that perhaps we should be proactive about it? Because on The Money Show, one of the big things we're talking about tonight is the fact that businesses have battled in the past. We had Soho Sun Gaming a little bit earlier on, and they were talking about the fact that they battled a year ago. Should we perhaps have another lockdown just to prevent a worse problem?
I think so. Even if you could go to level 3, I think it's better. But because now you can see the thing that affected us is the election. And because the ruling government wanted votes, they couldn't stop this. They wanted votes, so they opened for everyone. Now, this is the consequences.
Yeah, yeah. Well, Maleta and Alex, thank you for your call. I really do appreciate it. Thank you so much. Yeah, it's a bit of a problem as well, but I'd like to hear from you this evening. This is The Money Show. We're talking about business. Should we be locking ourselves down or should we not? Because, if you have a look at what's happened before and the sort of detrimental effect that it has on our local economy, the booze ban as well, and going back to, number one, what they're going to do, they're going to lock us down. They're going to say, right, no booze from, say, you can buy from, say, Monday to Thursday, but nothing Friday, Saturday, Sunday. Then it becomes worse. Then it's a total ban. Are these bans effective enough when it comes to this? A few SMSs coming through on 31702. One says, Ray, you're talking absolute nonsense. We should not lock down this country. Not sure if I agree with you, not just because you said I'm talking nonsense, but because of the fact that, when it comes to locking down things once again, this might be the only solution that we perhaps have on this. I'd like to hear from you. 011-883-0702.
Because some journeys are better taken together.
Let's walk the talk. 702.
4 minutes to 7 o'clock. Ray in for Bruce this evening. And we've been talking about all sorts of things this evening a little bit earlier on, speaking to Soho Sun Gaming. And they were telling us that the results are up. They managed to get their results up despite the pandemic. And you'll know if you go to Monte Cassino or other casinos as well, you'll see that people are gambling, that things are not sort of back to normal, but they're getting back to normal. There are fears, though, that as we go into level four of the lockdown, or level four, rather, the fourth wave, rather, and we perhaps will see a lockdown, that there may be problems in within business. I'd like to hear from you, though. 011-883-0702. How do you feel about this? How do you feel about the fact that there could be this, and how should we be dealing with this? One or two SMSs coming through. One from JP. He says, Ray, good evening. Good to have you on The Money Show. Thank you. Saying that a lockdown would be a very good idea, but not sure about the liquor trade. So that is a problem as well. Another one says, Ray, I'm simply fed up and hutful. I think you could say that on radio. He's just fed up because he's got to the situation where, this is where we're sitting at the moment. So, I'd like to hear from you. A little bit later on, we'll be taking a closer look at this. Also coming up on The Money Show in the next hour, talking Air South Africa and the next hotspot for mergers and acquisitions. So that's an interesting discussion. Thereafter, how do you build a business when capable talent is scarce or unaffordable? And I like this topic. That's with Pavlos Fotidis. He's at the founder at Auric Business Accelerator. operator. How do you do that? Build a business when capable talent is scarce or unaffordable. We see this in the journalism trade as well, when there are only so many people who have been trained. Do you, for your business, do you have a business where you are having interns, you're bringing them in? I'll be chatting to Pablo about that a little bit later on. And then thereafter, looking at where you should put your cash, asking the question, I love this, why is smoking or eating junk food the same as investing all your money in cash? That's coming up with Warren Ingram a little bit later on, talking about where to put your money. A lot of people saying in these days, this day and age, should we be putting our money into perhaps property? Should we perhaps be putting it into something else? Going back to our discussion, talking about the lockdown, what should we be doing with that? And on Twitter at the moment, JP again on Twitter, you're also on the SMS as well, saying that there should be a lockdown. Sequoia says there shouldn't be, arguing about that as well. What about the liquor trade? Somebody else says that we wasted the first couple of months of the lockdown. That's back in March. We wasted it with President Cyril Ramaphosa saying, no, there's a bit of a problem with this. We shouldn't have done this. So, yeah, lots to talk about this evening. I'd like to continue this discussion throughout the evening. Something else that we have, though, is shareholders at Botswana and Johannesburg listed supermarket giant Choppies have won a major court victory in their battle to recover damages of more than 621 million rand from auditors PricewaterhouseCoopers and its managing partner Rudy Benadel. Now, Benadel has been harshly criticized by a Botswana judge who found he had delayed the Choppies Enterprises audit report because of a job he had been offered. It didn't work out at Choppies, and they're saying that's because that's the reason why that audit report didn't come out. Joining us is Choppies CEO Ram Ottapatu. Hi, Ram. Good evening. Welcome to The Money Show.
Thank you, and good evening to you.
Take us through the shocking finding. What exactly happened here?
We've been complaining that the auditor was not independent in discharging his duties. That is why we took the matter to the court. And that's what the court found out, that there's the question of independence being implied here. The rest of the matters are still in front of the court. Let me rather don't go into details of that. But our first round of that is just that, the issue of the independence.
Right, Ram, you are coming to us from Botswana, so it is a bit of a bad line. What happens now? Is there going to be an appeal process? What happens next? What are you anticipating?
We expect the trial to take place from next year, because the court have said they will not entertain any more extension of the time or anything like that. And PwC has been asked to give all the particulars what our lawyer has been asking. And that's the judgment. They've been delaying, or they're not coming forward to give us the details. And they've been forced to accept a date, and the judge have reiterated the issue of independence.
Right, it's a bit of a bad line, like I said. Ram Ottapatu, thank you so much for chatting to us. Choppy CEO on the line from Botswana. Just some background to that story, if you couldn't hear what Ram was saying. Shareholders at Botswana and Joburg-listed supermarket giant Choppies have won a major court victory in their battle to recover damages of more than 621 million rand from auditors PricewaterhouseCoopers, also its managing partner Rudy Benadel. Now, Benadel has been harshly criticized by a Botswana judge who found he had delayed the Choppies Enterprises audit report because a job he had been offered at Choppies had not materialized. He's been found guilty of that. I'm sure we will be following this story very closely on The Money Show. It's just after 7 o'clock.
702
on 92.7 and 106 FM.
Streaming on 702.co.za.
The 702 app.
And on DStv channel 856.
Just gone 8 minutes past 7 o'clock. Good evening from me, Ray White, in for Bruce on The Money Show, which is brought to you by APSA CIB, winners of the best service in Africa at the Euromoney Cash Management Survey 2021. That's Africanacity. APSA is a registered FSP. Coming up on your program in the next hour, talking, is South Africa the next hotspot for a mergers and acquisitions boom? And think about it. If you are going to merge with someone, is it a strategy that you need to take to perhaps survive COVID-19. If you put yourself together with somebody else, you can perhaps make some money out of that. Also looking tonight at how do you build a business when capable talent is scarce or unaffordable? And that's the thing. Do we still have interns, programs where we are looking at building new people, getting them into the so-called stream of employment? Or are we just losing our last professionals? Or perhaps are our professionals going overseas? They've decided more money overseas, so therefore we're going. Are we replacing them? Well, I'll be chatting to Pavlo Fotidis. He's the founder at Auric Business Accelerator about this one. And then also asking the question, I love this. Why is smoking or eating junk food the same as investing all your money in cash? So talking to Warren Ingram about that. Where should you be putting your cash? Love to talk to you. Perhaps you have a thought on this. You can give me a call, 011-883-0702, 021-446-0567. Or perhaps you just want to leave a message or SMS me on 31702 or 31567.
702. Let's walk the talk.
Streaming countrywide on the 702 app.
Talking now about mergers and acquisitions, are we going to see a boom? And think about it. Like I said, will companies be getting together? Number one, because it's safety when you get together. Two companies get together, you can stick up for yourselves as well. And also as well, maybe this is also an indicator of the local economy. On the line is a Translink Corporate Finance and SA CEO, John Blake. Hi, John. Good evening. Welcome to The Money Show.
Good evening, Ray, and good evening to your listeners.
Right. Are we looking at a boom? And if we are, why are we looking at a boom?
Ray, we are definitely seeing a trend developing. And if we consider Heineken's recent proposed offer for Distell, DP World's recent proposed offer for Imperial Logistics, and the recently concluded deal where PepsiCo acquired Pioneer Foods, and more recently, we see Mondelez, the U.S. branded snack business, in talks with ABI Food. And I think this is indicative of a coming trend in the South African business dynamic of large multinational foreign acquirers of local, well-run and well-positioned companies. And the most interesting thing about this trend, Ray, is the fact that these South African companies are being acquired at a significant discount compared to their peer companies offshore.
Okay, so that's probably why. So we are quite attractive if that is the case, aren't we?
Yes. I mean, we've looked at over 145 mid-market size transactions in the last 4 years in South Africa, and the average EBITDA multiple, that's earnings before interest, tax, and depreciation, paid for local South Africans about 6.2 times EBITDA, while in the equivalent period in Europe, the average multiple for a mid-sized company would be 11 to 12 times.
Okay.
And not only, I think, do South African companies present significant value for money for offshore acquirers, these companies are often, if you look at the primary driver, strategic driver behind these acquisitions, it's often establishing a footprint in the South African market, which would lead to wider African-wide expansion. And our foreign acquirers, with the reduced cost of capital and the scale that they bring to the party, are often in a much better position to effect that aggressive expansion into Africa than their local counterparts.
John, if you have a look at some of the issues that we've had over the past year, we had our looting in July, we've had things like this. From the way you are sounding this evening, it sounds like, companies don't really care. That there was then, they can see something different. And like you say, it's just a very attractive thing to do.
Well, yes. We believe that the economic fundamentals are still in place, especially those companies that are addressing the emerging consumer market in Africa. There are still a lot of low-hanging fruit in the South African and African markets compared to overseas markets, which are often more mature. And if you look at it on a sector-by-sector basis, often you find in any given sector in South Africa, the sector dominated by two or three large companies, and then there's a missing middle compared to the smaller companies at the bottom end of the pyramid. And it's our opinion that South African companies are often more profitable than their overseas counterparts because they lack that competition from mid-size companies which form the bulk of the makeup of any given sector in the overseas market compared to locally.
That would make a lot of sense.
And hence present an attractive market opposition.
Yeah. Is a weak rand also helping here as well? Because a lot of people with their pounds and their dollars are saying, okay, we'll just take them to South Africa because we can buy more.
Absolutely. I mean, the primary reason for the discount that our local companies are trading at and transacting at is this. It's reflected in our weaker currency, it's reflected in our long bond rates, and it's also reflected, of course, in our cost of capital.
Yeah. John Blake, Translink Corporate Finance and SACO, talking to us from Cape Town. Good to have you on The Money Show.
The Money Show.
Small business.
With Pavlo Fatidis.
Talking this evening, rain for Bruce, by the way, but talking this evening, how do you build a business when capable talent is scarce or unaffordable? Joining us is Pavlo Fatidis. He's the founder at Auric Business Accelerator. Pavlo, hi. It's been a while.
It has been, Ray. How are your skills coming along? Because if they're growing, you're becoming scarcer and scarcer, not only in South Africa, but across Europe, across the UK, across the economy of the United States. Already one of the big issues that are delaying the over $1 trillion investment in infrastructure across the US is the fact that there aren't enough, for example, Ray, surveyors.
Hmm. That makes sense.
That actually makes sense,
Pavlo. It really does make sense. What worries me the most, what worries a lot of people the most, is this is only going to get worse.
Well, I think it's going to get worse before it gets better. And here's the reality. If you're a business owner, the global shortage of skills is not a problem, Ray, if you don't want to grow. And here's the thing. If you're not growing within your industry, within your sector, I promise you, you are dying. And the reason is because there are competitors in your environment that in South Africa, where the economy generally grows very slowly or very poorly because of government policy and all sorts of other issues in our past, the only place to get growth is to outcompete and outplay your competitors. So if you are satisfied to grow your business at inflation plus 1 or 2%, which is where most businesses in the mid-tier are growing, Ray, be warned, beware. Mm. Forearmed is forewarned. You have got competitors out there that out of necessity are growing. If you want to grow, then you have to build a business that will lessen the reliance on your growth being dependent on skills. Because if those skills are around, they're going to be scarce. They're going to be expensive. And Ray, I know I'm going to upset a lot of people.
Yeah.
But they're going to be unreliable because that's just the nature of scarce skills. They will move to where the next buck is higher.
That's interesting, where the next buck is higher. But isn't this good news for those who are listening to this interview? And I say that because many, many youngsters will be looking at careers and perhaps they want to become something that is scarce. Perhaps they want to make a lot of money.
Well, go do it. Go forth, my warrior. Go forth and make a lot of money. Mm. If you're building a business to make a lot of money, and that's your ambition and drive in starting the business, I would be very, very surprised to see you last more than a year to 3 years. If you're building a business to do something useful for society, well, then you're going to have a far greater and far longer lasting impact. Because here's the reality. Your customers don't care, Ray, if what you are doing, you're doing in order to make money, if that's your ambition. Your customers, whoever they are, will care because you can solve a problem for them and you can do so for fair value through a good experience. So if you're going to start a business, don't start with the ambition of saying, I want to be mega wealthy. I want to make a ton of cash.
Yeah.
Start with the ambition saying, I'm going to build a business that will be in service of society. More importantly, in service of a well-defined group of customers that I want to serve. And in order to do that, my product is irrelevant. My service is irrelevant. My price is irrelevant. The only thing that matters in those early stages is to identify who that customer is, that group of customers, and then go and ask them, what problem can I solve for you if I'm in the injection molding industry, if I'm an architect, if I'm in food services? How does that problem that you have that I can solve with my product and service come about? What should my product and service look like? What criteria should it have? What features should it have? What pricing should it have? What support should I provide around it to make the experience of you buying the product or service to solve your problem consistently and consistent enough for you to do it again and again and again with me? That's the starting point of any business. If you go into business with that in the front of your mind, you're in for a winner. You know, something interesting, Ray.
Yeah.
282,000 people in the US in this last quarter who lost their jobs through COVID lockdowns and the economy never filed for unemployment insurance.
That's interesting.
And the reason they never did it is because they've all identified opportunities to solve problems for groups of clients and customers that they had found, discovered, and learnt about during their period of previous employment.
Sure.
But it is a great time to start a business for that reason alone.
I mean, Pavlo,
because
that's quite incredible. What I'm trying to say is quite incredible. It shows entrepreneurship. It shows gusto.
Yeah, it shows gusto, but more importantly, for those individuals to feel confident, right? Because I promise you, in South Africa, most people, and this is true globally, you know, the States has quite a strong exception around it, but globally, most people start a business out of sheer necessity. So in the early stages when you start your business, yes, of course you're starting it to make money. And of course you're starting it to put food on the table for your family. But if that is the driver, shift and switch your mind to say, how can it be a useful business? Because that's the only way to make it a sustainable business.
Yeah, you're quite right. You're quite right. Now, something else I want to touch on as well, that's building yourself. That's building your business. But going back to that skills shortage, should we not be retaining more interns? Should we not be building our business? Perhaps even put a clause in to say, you've got to work with me for 5 years, then you can't leave. Something like that.
Yeah, you know, we have a very, very inflexible labor law that makes it very difficult to be more creative around giving young recruits real opportunities. And I feel sorry for anyone who's at that very, very early stage of their careers, because you apply for a job, they look at your CV. Firstly, there's nothing to show. Secondly, the person says, well, I tell you what, Ray, come back when you've got some experience. Mm-hmm. I like you as a person. I like your values. I like your character. But you don't know anything and you know nothing, and that makes you perfectly useless to me and expensive for me to hold on to. So come back when you have experience. And you sit there scratching your head saying, well, where am I going to get the experience if nobody's going to give me an opportunity?
Yeah.
And there are a number of different approaches that you can choose to take. A number of different approaches. In my very, very first ever real opportunity, I bought a business, Ray, for a rand, but I took on all the debt and all the risk at 22. And it was hell. From 5 a.m. to 10 p.m., literally for the first 3 years. But eventually, thankfully, it turned around. Another approach is to go to a company and say, listen, I believe in your business. Really? You do, Ray? Yeah. Show it to me. And you need to demonstrate that you've thought about the business, you've thought about the products, you've thought about what they do, you've been onto the website, you've actually researched them, and you are you're committed to wanting to be in that industry, in that business.
Mm.
And then the person's going to say to you, thank you very much, Ray, but you have no experience.
Yeah, problem.
And you're going to say, yes, I know. But here's the deal. Pay simply for my transport and allow me to put some food on the table. 3,000 rand a month, 2,000 rand a month for the first 3 months. Give me tasks and let me show that I have the ability to listen. I have the ability to learn. I have the ability to be diligent. I have the ability to be responsible. And at the end of the 3 month period, you would have gotten all those qualities for a mere 3,000 rand per month. And then we can sit down and reassess where I can be useful for fair play, for fair wage.
Yeah, yeah.
It's another way of building up experience where you never had it before.
Is it not, Pav, is it not also about the type of person that you are employing, or perhaps the type of person that you are? Because not everybody, you give somebody 3,000 rand, they may squander that. It takes that special person with drive to say, take a chance on me and I'll do this. We don't have enough of those people.
Well, you know what? That's also a choice, because the one thing everybody has 100% control over is their attitude. And the attitude you choose to hold in your brain, in your head, will, without you realizing, change the way that you behave every day. And the way you behave, the activities, the actions that you perform, build out the result of your life without fail. You know, Ray, whenever I walk into a business, I always ask the business owners, what do you do every month, then every week, and then I move into every day? Because the actions of each and every day tell me what your attitude is towards your business and can also soothsay and forecast the future outcome of your business. And I think that's a pretty remarkable thing.
Yeah.
When somebody understands that the way I behave today is because of how my attitude is. And given that I've got control over my attitude, because I can choose to change my mind, it will change my behavior and it will give me a different result. We have a remarkable degree of control, not only over our lives, ourselves, but especially the future of our businesses.
Yeah, I like that. It's all about attitude. Pavlos Fotidis, founder at Auric Business Accelerator. Good to have you on The Money Show. And I think that's the whole thing. It comes down to that. What is the attitude you're going to have with your business to other people? And perhaps that rubs off on the people that you employ, the people that you see every single day. And perhaps you get to the point where those people want to be like you. They want to take over your business. They want to do something with it. Good discussion this evening. It's just gone 7:30.
The Money Show with Bruce Whitfield, proudly brought to you by Absa Corporate and Investment Banking. Proud winners of the best service in Africa at the Euromoney Cash Management Survey 2021. That's Africanacity. Absa is a registered FSP.
The Money Show.
Personal finance with Warren Ingram.
And personal finance is brought to you by IG Markets. IG Markets South Africa is an authorized financial services provider. CFD losses can exceed your deposits. Good evening to Warren Ingram, who's a personal financial advisor and also the executive director at Galileo Capital. It's been a while, Warren.
It has, Ray. It's great to chat to you.
Absolutely. I love the topic tonight. Why is smoking or eating junk food the same as investing all your money in cash? Do tell us.
So I think it's about the kind of risks that we're taking when we're, if you smoke or eat junk food over long periods of time. And you know, to me, that's called a slow risk, because now, if you eat, you know, really lousy junk food, you know, every day of your life for 20, 30 years, there isn't going to be, you know, one burger or, you know, one piece of fried food. I'm so careful not to say companies' names here, but you get my gist. There won't be one meal that you take that that actually makes you sick or gives you heart disease or, you know, diabetes or something like that. It will be a collection of decisions that you've taken to eat that food and to have those meals day after day after day for long periods of time. And eventually, you are nearly certain to develop some kind of health problem. It might not be something that, you know, that's completely fatal, but it is absolutely guaranteed to give you health issues. And in life, that's considered a slow risk. A fast risk is something that's really obvious. You know, it's for example, it's not wearing your seatbelt, you know, borrowing too much money or cheating on your spouse. Mm. All of those are going to have immediate consequences if something goes wrong. You know, if you don't wear your seatbelt and you have a car crash, you're going to have an injury. You might die. Cheat on your spouse, you know, you're likely to get divorced or get into serious trouble. Borrow too much money and you're going to go broke. Those are fast risks. And those are things that, because the consequences are so immediate, we tend as human beings to be programmed to avoid those risks. You know, most normal humans anyway would avoid those risks. And so if we look at the world of investing, you know, I would consider a fast risk to be something like, you know, buying an investment like, you know, in the stock market, where, you know, our job, I guess, you know, when we're talking about things is to talk about stock market crashes, for example. It'll be a topic in the media. It'll be a topic among our friends. And that will be the same as a car crash. It's attention grabbing. The consequences are immediate. And so for most of us, we would say, well, hang on, you know, that's not something I want to expose myself to. I'm going to wear my seatbelt, you know, and the equivalent of kind of avoiding, you know, the fast risk in the investment world is to put your money in the bank.
Yeah.
Or even worse, put it under the mattress. And then you feel completely safe because, you know, day after day, you're just getting this, you know, little bit of interest and you know there's no big fast crash going to happen. So you feel absolutely safe. And you know, as the days and weeks and months go by, you know, everything seems fine because nothing's ever gone down. You haven't experienced any kind of a big crash. Unfortunately, that's the same as eating the junk food day after day after day or having, you know, packets of cigarettes day after day. There isn't going to be the one day that really alerts you to the problem that you've created for yourself. But the longer you do that, the longer you keep your money in cash and the longer you avoid investing in shares and productive assets, the more likely you are that you're actually injecting your investments with the slow poison. And unfortunately, that's interest on cash.
Mm.
Because, you know, cash just doesn't generate a return once you've taken inflation into account. You know, so if you're earning 4 or 5% a year on your money at the moment, just understand that, you know, if inflation's running at 3, 4, or 5%, and you take some kind of tax off the interest that you're earning, the likelihood is that you're actually going backwards, you know, every year once you've taken inflation and tax into account. And, you know, you do that for a decade or two, and unfortunately, your money is depleted. You might yeah. still have cash, but what you've lost is the buying power of that money. It's just absolutely gone.
Yeah. Warren, how are we looking then with our RAND? Now, talking about cash, and I see what you're saying. Don't just have cash because it depreciates, et cetera, et cetera. But would it not be a good idea to perhaps buy pounds or dollars or somebody else's cash because our RAND's not doing too well?
Our RAND's not doing too well today and maybe this week and you know, potentially for the month of November. But just rewind to, let's say, March last year. And there the RAND was nearly, you know, 17 to the dollar. And so we must remember that, you know, the RAND is just by its nature, a very volatile currency. So it does go shoot up and, you know, and then we all panic because it's now at 17 to the dollar. Then it starts to strengthen. It doesn't do it in the same way and at the same speed as it weakens. But what's interesting about the RAND is when the environment and I guess the economic circumstances are there for the RAND to strengthen, it does it fairly consistently over a, you know, over a fairly short period of time. Yeah. And so, you know, again, we don't really get the headlines to say, whoa, you know, watch out, the RAND's suddenly stronger. You know, that doesn't grab attention. What grabs the attention is the RAND lost 4% today and watch out, you know, the world's going to end. And so I think from my perspective, Worrying too much about the currency over short periods of time, it just is really a loser's game, because number one, we can't predict what the rand's going to do tomorrow. You know, if the American president wakes up and is saying something interesting today for the world about stimulating the American economy or something, or the Chinese premier does the same, early tomorrow morning, we could wake up to see the rand at 14.90 to the dollar, and it would have been a completely unpredicted event that caused that to go up.
Yeah.
So if you're asking me my view on panicking about the rand, I think it's a waste of time, hugely energy consuming, and often leads to investment mistakes. I think you should peg yourself a level for the rand, for example, for almost nearly, it's really close to 2 years now, Ray, I've been saying 15 rand 50 to me is the right level for the rand against the dollar. So if the rand is sitting at 15 rand or 15 rand 10, and you need to buy overseas investments, then by all means buy your overseas investments, because the rand is actually a bit better than it should be. But when the rand is sitting at 15.90 to the dollar, be patient, because the likelihood is it's going to come back to you. That doesn't mean that I'm never change my view. I just think we need to be careful that of the noise of the rand, because it is a noisy currency. It does move all over the place, but over a 5 or 10 year period, it does gradually decline against the dollar, because our inflation is higher than theirs. But it can do it in wild swings, and so there will be times to buy dollars again. And now is really not one of those times to panic and just send all your money out because rand's weakened a bit. I think we need to understand why. It's not South Africa. It's actually a country north of our borders on the Mediterranean. It's called Turkey. And, unfortunately, their president is acting like a Turkey, and it's causing a whole lot of issues. But those get washed out of the system again. And then the environment is still favorable for the rand. When the oil price in dollar terms is high, that tells you that the demand for commodities is there, and that's good for South Africa. So I would hate to predict the currency and say it's going to come back next week or next month, because then it'll do exactly the opposite and make me look like a fool, like it's done before. But I'm not panicking about the rand now.
No, absolutely. It's 15.93, looking at what it is doing to the dollar at the moment. We're chatting to Warren Ingram about slow risk, and it may be a bit of a killer. It's like the junk food that you eat. Some of your questions, perhaps, 011-883-0702, or you can also SMS us on 31702.
The Money Show with Bruce Whitfield, proudly brought to you by Absa Corporate and Investment Banking. Proud winners of the best service in Africa at the Euromoney Cash Management Survey 2021. That's Africanacity.
Absa is a registered FSP.
The Money Show.
Personal finance with Warren Ingram.
Right, talking personal finance and where to put your money, and talking about a slow risk. Now, Warren, I got a question for you. It's a listener question, actually. It says, yeah, good day, Warren. My parents are part of the government employees pension fund through their employment, which I think is a good retirement plan. They also use retirement annuities and fixed deposits to save. Their plan is to retire in 12 years, and I'm worried that the fixed deposits will not give them the best return over this time. How can they best invest their money, and what type of investment should they consider? And that's from Mpo. Your answer.
It's a brilliant, brilliant question, because, firstly, just to explain a little bit about the Government Employees Pension Fund, it is underwritten ultimately by government. So when you retire from Government Employees Pension Fund, you actually get an old school, old fashioned pension. In other words, they're going to say to you, when it comes to your time of retirement, they're going to say, okay, you've been working for us for a long time. You've been contributing to this pension fund. We're now going to pay your pension, as an example, of 40,000 rand a month. And we hope and expect that it should go up with inflation every month for the rest of your life. So it's something that you can kind of take to the bank, right? Because it's given to you by the Government Employees Pension Fund. And for those that don't know, that's a very big fund. There's a heck of a lot of money in there. But if that actually runs out of money one day and you're still alive, the government itself stands as the guarantor for that. In other words, it's Ray and me and every other taxpayer in the country, because we're paying our tax, and that's the money that goes to government, and that's what government will have to use to guarantee those pensions if something goes wrong with the GEPF. I'm not saying that it will, because I think the GEPF in most years and most decades is well managed. But But what that means for someone who's retiring is they've already got a portion of their retirement money absolutely locked in and guaranteed. What isn't guaranteed is that their income might not increase at the rate of inflation. Now, that's something that they will the GEPF will try to do, but that certainly can't be something that they will ever guarantee. You know, if inflation goes crazy or stock markets collapse for 20 years, there might not be enough increases every year to match inflation.
Okay.
So if I look at this, and Impor's concern, I think, is correct. You know, Impor's parents already have a very safe investment in the GEPF. So to then lock in some of their money into fixed deposits where they're not taking any risk and guaranteeing themselves a rate of interest might feel like a smart thing to do. But unfortunately, fixed deposits aren't great at giving you inflation beating returns, especially when you take tax into account. And that's my concern here. They actually need to take some investment risk in productive assets.
Yeah.
And my view is, if Impor's asking what those look like, you know, that could be something like an exchange traded fund, which just buys, you know, the top 40 or top 50 shares in South Africa, or, you know, a world index exchange traded fund, you know, something that gives them the ability to yes, they are going to take risk. Yes, it will be volatile. It will go up and down over time, but they've got enough time left to retirement. You know, Impor's saying 12 years from now that they can afford to take the risk. And realize that once they retire, life isn't over. They're still going to live for a few decades after retirement. So they can afford to take the risk of investing in the stock market.
Mm.
And with their retirement annuities, I think that those are fine, provided the retirement annuities are low cost. You know, they shouldn't be very expensive. And secondly, that the investments of those retirement annuities are largely biased to shares, so that they make sure that they are getting good capital growth. Because unfortunately, Ray, you know, the way that they're going to buy their replacement cars in future, or, you know, fix the house or the roof or whatever it is, you know, any kind of ad hoc expense won't come from the pension. You know, that's a monthly income.
Yeah.
They need other capital that they can call on, you know, at short notice, or, you know, perhaps if it's a car, it might be with slightly longer notice. But they will need extra money, and that money does need to grow a lot faster than inflation. So they're going to have to take some risk, but then live with the risk, understand that it goes up and down, but over a long period of time, the stock market's a great place to be, you know, when you've got a decade or two in your investment horizon. It doesn't lose money over those kinds of time frames.
Yeah, so it's actually interesting that you say that. There's an SMS that's coming in and says, how do you go into the market now at such a high? And I suppose the all shares over 70,000 and many equities are doing really well, but where do you go now? Is it just a case of careful shopping perhaps?
The stock market's hit an all-time high, but I wish I had the numbers at my fingertips about when it breached that high before, because what we must never forget is, you know, the infamous lost decade. Yeah, we've had a long period of time where the stock market just hasn't been delivering growth at all. You know, there was certainly a five-year period in the recent past where the JSE didn't even beat inflation. And so just to understand that this all-time high, it's not as if we've been breaking all-time highs year after year after year for the last 5 or 10 years. We've really struggled to get any kind of return from the JSE that's been meaningful. Mm. So what's happening now is we're actually only starting to recover lost growth now. And my view is there are a lot of legs in the JSE. There's a lot more growth that can come from our stock market. So this all-time high is a little bit misleading. So my view is, if you've got a lump sum that you need to invest in the JSE, by all means, take that amount, divide it into six, and then feed it into the JSE every month in equal parts over 6 months. So phase it in over 6 months. But if you've got a debit order, don't be afraid to commit that whole debit order into the JSE, consistently. Because I think, you know, I'm really comfortable the JSE can get, you know, a lot higher from here before it becomes expensive. It's by no means expensive now.
Yeah. Another one here says, great topic, Warren. Learning a lot. I invest most of my money into my RA. Is it a decent investment compromise for an anxious investor like me? That's from Bulumko in Burgundy Estate.
So I love low-cost retirement annuities. I hate the ones that are really expensive. So I've seen lots of retirement annuities offered by insurance companies that are, and I'm not saying the insurance companies old school, but the retirement annuities old school, where the fees are somewhere around, you know, 3.5% to 5% a year, and that's going to be charged to the investor for the next decade, you know, if not longer. And to me, those are really awful investments because, you know, if your fees are 3.5% a year and inflation is running, let's say, at 4% a year, that means your investment needs to generate, you know, at least, let's say, 7.5% a year just for it to stand still. And I think that's a very tough benchmark. So yeah. I love retirement annuities, but you really want them to be, you know, the modern ones that are offered by investment companies where, you know, you're not paying much more than, let's say, 1% to 1.5% a year. In which case, you know, the tax benefits that you get from your retirement annuities are really good. You know, one of the things people forget, Ray, is that, you know, the money that you've got invested in an RA, it grows without paying any tax. So an RA itself doesn't pay income tax, capital gains tax, dividends tax. That's a huge benefit. Then we get all the benefits of contributing to our RA. So I like RAs. I think the anxious person there doesn't need to be anxious if they're in the low cost, you know, kind of modern RA.
Right, in 30 seconds, our phrase for the week, what are debentures?
So debentures, nothing to be confused with dentures, which is the things we put in our mouth when we lose our teeth. These are debt instruments. So typically something that pays you a rate of interest every month, often offered by companies. They're nice because the company promises to pay you a rate of interest for a period of time. The thing to know, though, is that the company doesn't give you any security for that debt. So it's unsecured debt offered by companies in most instances. And so the interest rates are usually quite good, but quite risky if the company's not financially sound.
There we go. Warren Ingram, personal financial advisor and executive director at Galileo Capital. Warren, great to chat to you once again.
Thanks so much.